It's a great pleasure for me and for Sue to welcome Rodney and Beverly Hawes to campus today. Look forward to hearing from Brother Hawes. Let me just give you a little bit of background about Brother Hawes, and then I want to share one little experience that we had with Rod and Beverly that was very sweet. Brother Hawes served as chairman and chief executive officer of Life Re Corporation for 10 years. Life Re was the largest independent life reinsurance company in the United States. He also founded Insurance Investment Associates of New Canaan, Connecticut, and has been involved in entrepreneurial interests and investments in computer software and consumer products and real estate. He and his family are developing the Five Guys Burgers and Fries franchises in several western states. It's a very distinguished career. Brother Hawes graduated from Stanford University with a bachelor's degree and has an MBA from Harvard University, where he was a Baker Scholar. He serves on several boards of directors and advisory committees and is a member of the National Advisory Council of the Marriott School of Management at BYU. He recently served in the Harvard Business School Campaign Advisory Committee and is a member of the Board of Dean's Advisors at the Harvard Business School. Brother Hawes has served the church in many capacities, including as a regional representative, a stake president, bishop, Sunday school teacher, and much else. He served as in the presidency of the Manhattan New York Temple. He and his wife Beverly are the parents of 6 children, and they have currently 24 grandchildren. I just share one little personal experience. Sister Clark and I have known Rod and Beverly for many years now, and we had a great experience with them on the campus of the Harvard Business School once. I just thought I'd share with you. The Hawes were instrumental in helping us build a classroom building, which is called Hawes Hall, on the campus of Harvard Business School. And we had a dedication ceremony for that building. It was held in the building. And Rod and Beverly, of course, invited their family and many other people that were friends. And they both spoke. And I spoke, and it was a great meeting. The Spirit came, and Rod and Beverly bore their testimonies, although they did it very appropriately, and talked about their deep love of education and deep love of the students and what the world needed as far as education was concerned, and we had a wonderful outpouring of the Spirit. A number of my colleagues said to me after that meeting was over, what was going on in that meeting? I've never been in a meeting like that. And some of my other colleagues who were members of the church said, you know, that was just like state conference. It was a sweet experience. So this is a man, Brother Hawes, who has the Spirit of the Lord with him. He's a very successful businessman, but he has the Spirit of the Lord with him and in everything he does. And we're grateful to have him here on the campus today. So, Rodney, I'll turn the time to you.
Thank you very much. I'm an Idaho boy. It's a little bit like coming home. Except when I come home, usually it's to the southwestern corner of the state. I grew up in a little town on the Snake River, so if you want to send messages down to me, throw a bottle in the river over here. And a little town called Marcine. It's about 18 miles from Nampa, 11 from Caldwell, 35 from Boise. This part of the world has influenced me a lot because when I graduated from college in California, I went to work for some folks in the insurance business in Boise, Mutual of New York. And the manager of the company was J. Richard Clark. And the associate manager was L. Alden Porter, named some of you are old enough to remember. They're emeritus now, but they went on to be general authorities in the church and very prominent leaders of the Seven Presidents of 70. We were not members of the church when we went to work for them, but the part I really was mentioning is that J. Richard Clark was actually raised in Rexburg, and Alden Porter was raised in Idaho Falls. So you see, I didn't have a chance even from the very beginning. And then soon after we joined the church, we went east to school, to graduate school. Today I've entitled this talk, I've been privileged to give. I've entitled it, Remember to Make a Difference. Make this place, this world, a better place when you leave it than when you found it. And I'd like to tell you first about a friend of mine. His name is Sir Ronald Cohen. Sir Ronald Cohen was knighted by the Queen in England. I met Sir Ronald when he wasn't Sir Ronald. He was Ronnie Cohen. I met him at the Harvard Business School. But let me tell you a bit about him. We became good friends over now 40-plus years ago. Ronnie Cohen was born of Jewish parents in Egypt. And in the mid-50s, I think it was 56, there was what they call the Suez Crisis. The French, as you history buffs will know, really ran that part of the world, ran the Suez Canal and Egypt. Ronnie Cohen's father, very Jewish family, had been for generations from that part of the world. Well, the Muslim leadership of Egypt threw the French out, took over the Suez Canal, and while they were at it, decided they'd throw all the Jews out too. And I mean throw them out. Ronnie Cohen was 10 years old. His family had to leave, and they let them take one suitcase apiece and leave everything they had behind. His father was a very successful businessman. They got lucky in the sense that his mother had a British passport. And so they were able to go to England. There was one small problem, is that the only languages that Ronnie Cohen knew were French and some Arabic, because that's where he was raised. He was 10 years old. Well, he lands in England, very bright young man, gets his education, certainly learns English, and is admitted to Oxford. Before he's through with Oxford, he becomes the president of the Debating Society, which is just about the highest honor you can get of one of the most prestigious organizations in that part of the world. Following graduation, he comes to Harvard Business School, which is where I met him. We were in the same section, and so every day for the first year, three classes a day, we shared together. Very bright young man. When he graduated, he and a couple of other business school guys formed a company. He moved back to England and started ultimately a venture capital firm. The venture capital firm became, if not the largest, I do believe it was the largest, but one of the most successful venture firms anywhere in the world, and he certainly was in Europe. How he became knighted and recognized was that he was asked to see if he could help solve some of the social problems in England, and he worked hard at it and helped with the poor and the needy and some business situations and so forth, and for that was rewarded with a knighthood. Recently, we had our 40th class reunion. It starts to tell you how old I am, about 100. I had talked to him from time to time. We've been involved in some fundraising activities there, and he's been very helpful in that regard, too. I said, Ronnie, what are you doing now that he's given up the chairmanship of his company? Guess what he's doing? He said, let me tell you, Palestine, the Palestinians are never going to be able to make it and solve their problem with the Israelis until they become independent and self-sufficient. And government handouts is not going to cut it. So myself and some friends have created a social enterprise fund, and we're going into the Palestinian side of the borders and trying to lend money to the very people, or at least maybe a generation down, of some of the same people that threw him out when he was 10 years old. I say that's making a difference. But I'd like to also suggest you don't have to be rich to make a difference. Just over the mountains here in Montana is a fellow that is, his name is Greg Mortensen. Greg Mortensen was a trauma nurse in the emergency room. That's how he earned his living. He would earn enough money because he really wanted to be a mountain climber, and he was a mountain climber, and he climbed mountains all over the world. In the mid-90s, he was on a climb of the famous K2, 28,000 feet. I think Bald Eagle and Deer Valley is 10,000. 28,000 feet. He was with a group, some of them European, climbing the mountain. They got within 600 meters of the summit, his dream to make the top of the summit. When the Frenchman of the group became ill, they'd been working at this for several weeks, had to come down the mountain, and so he helped bring him down the mountain until he could get down low enough that a helicopter could pick up the man and take him to safety, which they accomplished. By the time he got down, he was too weak, he, Greg Mortensen, to make the rest of the climb back up. So he missed his chance to make the summit, his lifelong dream. So he started down the mountain, since he was too weak to go up the mountain, and the other people had gone with the sick person in the helicopter and onward. So he started down the mountain, and storms came, one thing and another. He got lost. He got on the wrong path. One of the local folks helping him came back, found him, got him back on the right path, and then went further on down. To shorten the story, Greg Mortensen finally stumbled into a small village. He'd missed the trail again. It wasn't where he was headed at all. Muslim community. They took him in, nursed him back to health. He was there for quite some time. While he was there, he noticed that there was no school, that the kids were practicing a certain amount of math and things, drawing with sticks in the dirt. He was so taken with this and with these Muslim people, he grew to love them, and he knew some of the language because he traveled in that part of Pakistan before. This is the Himalayas. That he said, "I'll build you a school." He figured it would cost about $12,000. And so, when he finally got well, he went home, and he struggled one way or another because you don't pay trauma emergency room nurses a lot of money. But he raised the $12,000. And he goes back to build the school, but the fathers, the group, the leaders of the Muslim group in the community said, what we really need more than a school is a bridge. Because it would, first of all, we'd have a hard time getting the materials here for the school in the first place, because there's this giant, these mountain cliffs, they go up and down thousands of feet. And so he said, okay. And they build a bridge. So he comes home and he raises some more money and ultimately goes back and builds a school. Well, we don't have time to tell you the rest of the story. It's not important. I'm telling you this. He lives across the mountain in Montana. It's the headquarters. He ultimately got a foundation going and raised some money. This single guy, with his drive and passion, has built 130 schools among the Taliban, who usually don't even educate women, but he convinced them that their girls needed education. So many of these schools are for girls. Now, is Greg Mortensen making a difference? Don't you think that some cowboys and cowgirls from Rexburg, Idaho can make a difference if some trauma emergency room nurse can do that kind of thing? How about the worth of one soul? BNC 1815. A number of years ago, my wife was a Laurel teacher, and she had taught a young lady in our ward and who grew up, went on to BYU, met her husband, was married, had four small children. She, in turn, became the Laurel teacher in Orem, Utah, where her husband was involved with the university, I believe. The day after Thanksgiving, a number of years ago, my telephone rings in New Canaan, Connecticut. "Hi, President, this is Chris." It's Chris and her husband. We chatted for a minute, and she said, "May I have a favor to ask of you." And I said, "Sure, Chris," remembering she was a family friend and everything else, and a wonderful young lady. I said, "What can I do for you?" They went on to explain that she had a rare form of cancer and had just a few weeks to live. The request was, would I speak at her funeral? I said, "Of course, if that's what you wish, I'll be there. I'll pray for your recovery. But if that's not the Lord's will, I'll be there." The weeks went between Thanksgiving and headed towards Christmas. We kept in touch. A few days before Christmas, in talking to her, she said, "A wonderful thing happened last night." I said, "What's that?" She said, "One by one, the Laurel girls have been coming in to see me. And there's been one girl that I hadn't seen, and she's been in somewhat inactive, and I've been quite concerned about her, and she came last night, and we talked, and we talked. And when she left, she promised me that she would be back. She will come back." And then Chris said, "If she," and she named her name, "comes back, all this will have been worth it." The worth of one soul is great. The day after Christmas, my telephone rang again. It was her husband. Chris has just gone to the other side of the veil. Of course, I flew to Utah. The funeral was at a stake center. It was huge. It was filled clear to the back. I was the last speaker. I spoke, and as I was nearing the end of my talk, I was prompted to tell the story of the young girl. And I finished. Closing hymn, closing prayer. And then everybody standing up, getting ready to go out to the cemetery. And I'm standing in the stand, and I look, and I see out of the corner of my eye a young girl. And her mother coming up against the traffic up to the front. She gets to the front and she said, "President, I just wanted you to know that I'm that young girl you were talking about, and I promise you I'm back." The worth of one soul. Any one of us can make a difference. A few years ago, my wife and I had an interesting experience. I told you I'm from a small town in the southwestern corner of this state. We don't have a lot of symphonies in Marcin, Idaho. We're living in Connecticut. Lincoln Center's less than an hour from our home. Beverly decided her husband needed some education, and so we made an appointment to go to the symphony at Lincoln Center. It was on a Friday. Not wanting to be late and not knowing what traffic was, we left early. We got jumped in the car, went to Lincoln Center, and for some reason there was very little traffic, and we got there very early and nothing else to do and nowhere else to go. We went in Lincoln Center, got our seats in the balcony and looking down, and we were so early that the workmen were just putting up the chairs and the music stands. They were just opening the curtains and doing that kind of thing. And one by one, then the symphony members came with their instruments and to tune up before the official start of the evening. In the middle of all this, I see a young girl walking in from the stage carrying sheet music. She walks over to the piano and puts the music down on the piano. Ah, the pianist. I'm brilliant, you know. She leaves. Pretty soon more come, they tune up, and that's quite a sound by itself. That's an education. All these people tuning up at the same time. All different things. Really. I guess it's to make you appreciate the symphony when they all play the same tune at the same time. Anyway, time comes, the conductor comes out, turns around, introduces the special guest of the evening is the pianist. Turns around, holds his hand out, in comes this lovely, lovely woman, considerably older than the young girl that I had seen in a beautiful gown, and sits down at the piano. So much for my brilliance. Conductor turns around, starts the music. Music is fantastic. About this time, I look back right by the piano, and I see the young girl sitting in the chair right by the piano. She reaches up, reaches the music, turns the page over. I said, "Beverly, did you see that?" She said, "See what?" I said, "The young girl. She's by the piano." And Beverly said, "She's the page turner." "What do you mean the page turner?" I said, "You saw her turn the page." So she opens the program and shows me that this is such an important job. She's listed in the program as the page turner. Yeah, part of the education complete. Anyway, I start paying attention. So the music is going forward. Fantastic music, by the way. And I start thinking, you know what? And I turn to Beverly and I say, "You know what? If the guys putting up the music stands had put one up that wasn't right, that was broken, or a chair that was broken, and it collapsed, it would mess up the whole program. There would be such a clatter and everything going on." I said, "Those workmen are very important." And then I get carried away. I get into the sound and everything else. And Beverly says, "Why don't we talk about it on the way home?" Which we did. But I learned a valuable lesson that night. In any organization, there are no unimportant people. Whatever your job is, it's important. I don't care if it's cleaning the blackboards at BYU, Idaho, or the custodian. There are no unimportant people. And you need to know that when you work in an organization. And don't think just because you walk out of here with a college degree that somehow you're better than the people. In fact, one of the great lessons in life is to learn that there are a lot of people working down in the trenches of a company or an organization or a college, university, that have the gift of common sense. And you could learn much from them. Valuable lesson learned. Matter of fact, I put together a list of 16 business lessons learned by Rod Hawes, entrepreneur, over the last 50 years. Won't take me 50 minutes to talk. I'm just going to read them. If during the question and answer or later this afternoon you want to ask me about something, I'm going to hit them hard and fast. But there are some lessons that I think some of these you should listen to. Number one, face reality. Don't live in fantasy land. You and only you are responsible for your future. Don't expect divine intervention to constantly save you. Think about that. Number two, if it's your business, be there. No one will look after your business like you will. If you don't look after your business, there will soon be no business to look after. Number three, don't be overly impressed by financial projections generated by computers. Challenge all of the critical assumptions supporting the input. I have whole file drawers full of so-called conservative projections on businesses that later failed or faltered. And by the way, I have never had anyone in 50 years give me a projection that they didn't call conservative. And I can attest most of them aren't. They thought they were. I won't question that part. Number four, startups. Startups always, listen to me, always cost more, take more capital than they originally planned, and it always takes longer than originally planned. Number five, the financial numbers of any deal have to be right, but the long-term success of every deal ultimately comes down to the quality of the management involved. Six, just because a person is intelligent, honest, truthful, morally clean, and reverent, do not assume that he or she has good business or financial judgment. Seven, if a proposed deal is too good to be true, avoid it like the plague. There's no Santa Claus and there's no free lunch and the greedy usually end up hungry. Number eight, making money comes from leveraging three things. Money, people, or knowledge, or all three. Nine, the major financial rewards of even successful startups rarely go to the original founders. One reason in Five Guys, we buy the franchise and we build it out. They spent 25 years learning how to do it. Why should we start over? 10. It's generally less risky to buy a going business and to build it than to start one from scratch. Example I just used. Number 11. And listen to this one. Always control the checkbook. If you really want to know what's going on in a company, analyze the checkbook. Follow the cash. Where did the money go and why? Accountants can often report bookkeeping profits while the company's actually going broke. Number 12, you will often learn more from your mistakes than from your successes. Discover your mistakes, admit them, and then fix them. I have my own example. A number of years ago, I invested some money in an insurance company in Florida. 30 days after I put the money in, the actuaries came along and said they had a problem with the reserves, wiped out all the money I just put in. Took me a year and a half to fix it. 13, customers first, honest service. I learned a lesson just a few years ago. We put a new laundry room in. Beverly and I go out, we buy the fanciest washer and dryer you ever saw in your life. Most expensive one. I was so proud I spent all this money. Didn't work. There was something wrong. We assumed it was the machinery. We were so unhappy with it, we went to another place in a little town just over the border from where we lived, a place called Albano Electrics, being run by third-generation folks. It's a little, it was called Albano Electric. They do some electrical stuff, but they sell appliances. We went in to see the young man who's the third generation running the place. Said, Fred, we got a problem. We want to get rid of these things we bought. We didn't buy them from you, and we apologize for that. We bought them somewhere else. Could you come and, I mean, would you sell us some new ones? What's the best thing? What should we have? He said, what kind do you have? And we told him. He said, that didn't sound right. Let me come and look. He comes to our house, coat and tie. He was on his way somewhere. Takes his jacket off, lays down on the floor, fiddles around the back of the thing, says it isn't hooked up right. That's what's wrong. You don't need new machinery. I said, well, what do we owe you? Oh, nothing. Someday you'll need something. Let me tell you how smart he is. We've done 4 kitchens and several laundry rooms since. Guess where we bought the stuff? 14, persistence and patience pay off. My business, the primary business I've had over the years, buying and selling insurance companies, sometimes as an investment banker and sometimes for myself and my partners. There was a company in Lamar, Mississippi, called Lamar Life, in Jackson, Mississippi, excuse me. It was owned by a wealthy banker. It was a fine little company. I called on him, and I made a promise to him. Every year I'd go, "Bob, I've come to talk to you. One of these days you're going to want to sell this company. I know where to put it. When you get ready, let me know. And meanwhile, nobody will ever know unless you tell them that I've been here." 17 years I called on Bob. One day I'm sitting in my office in Connecticut, the phone rings. "Rodney, it's Bob. I'm ready." Jumped on the next plane, went down, sold the company to some people in South Africa. Had one little hitch just before we closed the deal. Is somebody kidnapped his wife and we had to wait a while. We had a terrible problem. Just an aside. Number 15, you earn your money in your own business and you lose it in someone else's. That came from my father. I should have listened to him. I've lost lots of money by getting involved in businesses that I don't know anything about. And the only money we've really ever made is in businesses that we do know something about. The last one is alert. Be alert to opportunities and seize the moment. In our family's life, the latest example of that is Five Guys. I'm labeled as being involved in this. I'm really just a banker. My son Tom, who's here today, who's an MD and a Harvard Business School graduate, was visiting his wife's family down in Virginia, sent him to get the best hamburger he'd ever have in his life while he's there. I'd have gone in, have a hamburger, and probably left. He goes in and finds out who owns the joint. "Best hamburger. Well, let's find out." "Oh, good. They're franchising." Picks up the phone, calls his brother Stephen, who's also here today. Stephen jumps on a plane with his partner and go back, and we're in the hamburger business. One's an MBA from Duke, and one's just got all these other degrees, and their other son is involved, and it's a good business. Okay, that's so much for that. Since we're on a roll, let's talk about 11 tips for becoming a better manager or leader. Protect your credibility. Your integrity, your reputation, and your credit. These are your most important personal assets. They take years to build, but only moments to destroy. Never, ever, ever compromise your integrity. If you're in a situation in a company and you're asked to do things that are not right and you know they're not right, you either correct it or leave. It just isn't worth it. A friend of mine told me one day, in fact, I learned this from an Idaho cowboy who I went to high school with. He does things on a handshake. He bought a bunch of cows to be delivered. And the market dropped right out from under him. All he had was a handshake. He took delivery of those cattle, even so, and almost went into bankruptcy. He said, "Your credit and your integrity is like fine silver. You never let it tarnish." He now owns one of the largest cattle ranches in all of Nevada. So I guess he knew what he was doing. Number 2, ask for advice. I've already covered this a minute ago. Go down in the trenches with very often the worker with very little formal education, but with a degree in common sense can solve a problem while some of us college graduates are still trying to program our computers. So go ask them what they think. Those years of experience are worth something. 3, praise coworkers, both in public and in private. We all work harder when we feel appreciated. Number 4, chastise in private. See Matthew 18:15. Number 5, share with those in the organization who help make it a success. In 1992, when my partners and I took Life Republic, put it on the New York Stock Exchange, we gave stock to every single employee right down to the guy in the mailroom. We converted employees into owners. The attitude in the place was incredible. When we sold the company just a few years later, we took it public at 22, we sold it at 95. We made a lot of happy owners, employees out of it. We were running the company with half as many people and five times the volume. Because if you have passion for your work and you're one of the owners, you pay attention. And I don't care whether it's a hamburger stand or a life insurance company. Learn something from church organization. Three heads are better than one. It's no accident that presidencies of church auxiliaries and organizations are made up of three persons. I really, frankly, think that my church experience, having been dropped in, I didn't have seminary, I didn't have any of those things. I was almost 30 years old when I joined the church. But being in bishoprics and stake presidencies and quorum presidencies and Sunday school presidencies, you just learn something with the magic number of three. Number seven, be of service to others. It's not only the right thing to do, but it will help you keep the proper perspective. Number eight, the business world is small, smaller than you think. Be fair, be loyal, be nice, be slow to burn bridges, be slow to anger. It's incredible how paths will crisscross over the years. Your competitor today may well be your boss tomorrow, or perhaps the purchasing agent for your best customer. Number nine, keep a people file or notebook of the names and addresses or company affiliation of those you meet. This is a simple little thing. It's amazing how often you can network back over the years if you have that information. Sometimes it'll be 3, 4, 5 years, and you'll pick up the phone and call somebody who can be very helpful and would like to be helpful, and they appreciate that you remembered them. Number 10, remember the money you earn isn't really yours. You are only a steward. Even J. Paul Getty and Aristotle Onassis didn't take it with them. And by the way, neither will Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, or Donald Trump. Last, number 11. And this is a simple trick to improve your effectiveness. Each night before you go to bed, take a 3x5 card. I'm talking to the wrong crowd. Get out your little handheld computer and list the five most important things you want to accomplish tomorrow. Then go to sleep, and when you wake up, go do them. And I say that before you go to bed because there's something happens. I swear your subconscious works on these things while you're asleep. Just seems to work. But you'll go to bed knowing what you're going to do tomorrow. And if you get up in the morning and you think of something that's more important that's on the list of five, then change it and go do it. Don't be a robot, but get on with it. Just 2 or 3 years ago, I was sitting at a luncheon at Brigham Young University at the Marriott School. Bob Gay was speaking. Some of you know Bob Gay. He's a terrific guy. One of the best businessmen in the world. And anytime I get a chance to be close to him or around him, I avail myself of that opportunity. And I'm sitting at this luncheon, and this fellow asked me, what's this business? Why'd you go off to Harvard and build that building? And why did you do something? You're interested in education and everything. Why didn't you do it here? And so I explained that a few years before I had tried to do it there at BYU. And the try to do it was, he said, what do you mean try to do it? And I said, well, I worked with the dean and some other people at the Marriott School, and our idea was that there's a serious problem with losing returned missionaries, native returned missionaries to South America. They come home, they can't get a job, they can't support their families, they get discouraged and not necessarily give up on the church, but they're just really down. And we can do a better job of getting people to go. And our idea was that we were going to build schools using church buildings was our original idea. And we would teach English so that they could get a job with American companies. We would teach basic accounting and the use of computers. And everybody got excited about, the dean was excited about. We were even going to change the schedule so that kids could do internships and go down there. We'd made some connections with some American companies, said we'll hire everybody we can get, and away we go. And then something happened. And we're not sure what. I've got an idea or two, but it didn't happen. And so I went off where I could be more appreciated, and Dean Kim Clark was the dean at Harvard Business School at that time. I didn't know him. Somebody introduced me to him, and he is, if you think he's soft, you got a wrong impression. He laid out this opportunity to change how leadership could make a difference in the world, and by golly, the only thing they really needed to get that done, at least at this moment in time, was a classroom building. I made the mistake of asking, what do you need? And I thought it was going to be a professorship or a scholarship or something. Buildings cost a little more than that. And we said we'd be helpful if it took us the rest of our lives, and it is just about. And then we get the building, and he leaves and comes to rescue all of us here. Anyway, I'm sitting at this luncheon, and I'm describing how this happened. And ironically, the man who did this to me is sitting in this audience today in the fourth row. I didn't even know him. And I tell him this story. He reaches down in his briefcase, and he picks up a brochure, and he opens it up, and it's entitled One Life at a Time. Opens up the brochure. There are two schools already open in Honduras. They teach accounting, English, and computers. I don't think it was any accident I was sitting by him. We made full circle, and I flunked out from, I didn't get it done. He's already doing it. And so Beverly and I are trying to help a little bit with that project. And Ross Farnsworth, who is the man I'm talking about in the fourth row, sorry to embarrass you, Ross, left his contracting businesses and devoted virtually full time to making this thing happen. So we've got our own Greg Mortensen in the building today. And there may be an opportunity for some of you down the road to get involved in this project. There are a couple more things I want to say before I run out of time. One is, here's a concept you need to understand. Each person is the center of their own universe. I don't care whether we're talking about your wife, your children, your boss, the guy across the street. There's one principle you have to understand if you're going to be successful in interpersonal relations or in negotiations or understanding your spouse or your boss or your employees. And that principle is this, that each person is the center of their own universe because each of us are the sum total of our own experiences, our environment, where we were born, how we were raised, who our parents were, less who they were than what kind of people they were. Because that's what we are, is the sum total of our own personal experiences. No two people are the same. It's from this unique composite. Think about it. That's how you look at things. When somebody says something to you, it either rings true or it doesn't or whatever. It's because of who you are. So every single person you meet can only look at the world, every problem, every situation, every opportunity from their own eyes and where they came from. So my advice to you is you better stop talking and spend more time listening, more time asking questions, more time understanding where the other person is coming from before launching into your sales pitch or your argument or your proposed solution. President Clark is the consummate person who understands this better than anybody I know. Before you know it, you're building a building at Harvard Business School. Great salesmen, great negotiators, great leaders understand this principle and treat others with respect, and more often than not succeed by first listening, by seeing the issues from the other person's point of view before presenting their own position. Now let me hit two or three other things quickly. Remember who you are. You're a child of God, and you're a member of Heavenly Father's earthly symphony. Your responsibility is to discover which part of the plan is yours to fulfill and how you can make a difference. Three quick things. in terms of personal focus that can make a difference to you. Have the faith of a child. When our daughter Kelly was a little girl, we lived on an acreage in Connecticut. Lots of trees, forest, backyard, several acres. She comes running in the house one day and she said, "Come help me, Daddy. What's happened? I lost my CTR ring in the woods." So, of course, good daddies do. You get up and you go out and you go look for it. Acres, ring this size. We look and we look and we look. I can get another CTR ring, no big deal. Until Kelly says, "Daddy, do you think we ought to pray about it?" Of course. We kneel down in the woods and pray. I said a very long prayer. I don't want to disappoint this little girl. I'm thinking of ways I'm going to make all the excuses. Folks, have the faith of a child. We end the prayer. We stand up, get ready to go. She turns around, looks down, and says, "Here it is, Daddy. Oh, ye of little faith." Share the gospel. One day I was on an airplane ride from Arizona where I'd been in meetings, and I was reading a church book, and there was an elder couple sitting right beside me. We're racing along. I'm reading my book, having a good time, and the lady says, "You seem very interested in this book. What's it all about?" It's a church book. So something goes ding. Shorten the story. I give my testimony, tell them how it's changed my life. I'm a convert to the church. I'm trying to learn more about it because I'm a relatively new convert to the church. And all of a sudden, her husband, who's listening, leans over and says, "Our daughter lives in Connecticut, and she's religious. Maybe she'd like to hear about it." Skipping ahead, I just happened to be the bishop, so we had access to some legs and arms, and we sent some folks out, and she and her husband joined the church. And just a few weeks ago, I sealed one of their daughters and new husband in marriage. One of the other daughters is married. We have four generations. Her mother joined the church, all out of one plane ride and one book and one open mouth. Now, tithing. Pay your tithing. We were in Boise, Idaho. The message was, yes, you're accepted to Harvard Business School. The only small problem was that we had just built a new house, had a new Cadillac and another new car. We couldn't go back to school unless I could sell the house and one of the cars. Put the house up for sale. First couple through was a young doctor, a surgeon who had come back, orthopedic surgeon. Loved the house, didn't make an offer, left. I took the car back to the Cadillac dealer, and I said, "I know I'm going to take a big haircut on this car, but I really need to sell the car." He said, "Son, we sell cars, we don't buy cars." So I drove it back home, put it in the garage. Weeks go by. A couple of months go by. 4th of July is coming. Finally, I'm getting desperate. We're supposed to leave in August. I still got a house and a car. I go in my little library and kneel down in this front of this big leather chair and I pour my heart out to the Lord. I said, "Father, I thought I understood the message that we were supposed to go. Can't go unless I get rid of this house and this car. I leave it in your hands. What do I do?" And then the voice comes. You know how it comes? You don't hear it exactly, but you do. You hear it in your head. It's as clear as if somebody was shouting at it. But what was the message? Pay your tithing. It's not December, it's July. Message again. Pay your tithing. I get up, I go around the other side of my little desk I still have, took out my checkbook and looked. I had about $1,200 in it. I figured out my tithing. I owed $1,100. It's 11 o'clock at night. I call the bishop. The bishop's my boss at work. It's J. Richard Clark. I said, "Bishop, I need to come and see you. I need to bring my tithing." "So bring it to the office tomorrow." I said, "No, I have to bring it tonight." I went over, paid the tithing. We talked till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, came home. Two days later, we lived on a cul-de-sac, and our garages, driveways came together, and I came out, and about that time, my neighbor came out. He said, "Rod, I understand you want to sell your car." I said, "Sure do." He said, "I think my dad might be interested in buying it for my mother." He was a plumbing contractor. Called him up, drove it down. Guy drove it around the block one time, wrote me a check, car gone. 2 days later, the doctor who had looked at the house several weeks and months before came back and bought the house. August, we loaded up our U-Haul trailer with our kids' bed and drove off to Harvard Business School. You think I don't ever fail to pay my tithing? Now, one last thing. I learned a lesson that was really important, and I hope it's important to you. Years ago, when I was stake president in that part of the world, West Point was in our state, and they allowed us to have our youth track meet at West Point. And the West Point track is a great field. It overlooks the Hudson River and across to the trees on the other side. It's fantastic, and the boats going up and down the river and everything. So I'm over there watching. I'm just observing. It's well organized, and the deacons do their thing, and the teachers and so forth and so on. It comes time for the 440 for the priests quorum. And this year, like every other year, the priests line up to go this one time around the track. And as usual, the lacrosse players and the track people and the football and basketball, the other athletes, they always win, and they always, and then the band members and the chess players and anybody else who wants to get in the lineup goes, and away they go. Lots of people. And they have a great time. I'm standing in the stands, and about the time the first guys go flashing over the finish line, I look up and I see on the other side of the track, halfway around, is a young guy straggling and struggling along. Step by step, and he's going to make it. Pretty soon the band members and the other guys go through, and he's now maybe 3/4 of the way around. I stand up to see who it is, because it was far away, and suddenly I realize who this young man is. He's a young man who was at birth handicapped, a touch mentally in the sense of ability to use it, and physically quite a bit. But he was determined to finish the race. And as he did, as he finally came down those last 100 steps, the rest of the guys who had finished the race long ago turned around and started to cheer. As he went over the finish line, you'd have thought he'd won a gold medal. The grin was from here to here, and everybody cheering for him. And on that beautiful spring day, I suddenly understood several principles much more clearly that this special child of God had taught me, had given me a glimpse of what it means to endure to the end. He taught me that each of us must run our own race in life, and that in the winning is often in the finishing. He taught me that when we get to the finish line, we will be judged more by what we did with the talents we were given than by how fast we ran the race. He taught me that the number of people greeting us when we get to the finish line is probably in some proportion to the number of lives we have touched in a positive way a long life's journey. And that to be loved, we must first love. So I tell you, my young friends, remember who you are, that you're a child of God. Remember that your major objective in life is not the gain of wealth, but if gained, it is for the purpose of helping others. Remember that your major purpose in life is to prepare to return home to your Heavenly Father. And a long life's way to help as many of your earthly brothers and sisters to do the same. Remember to make a difference.